Our next case is 13-688, State of Ohio versus Brandon Lee Hoffman. Mr. Klukas.
Madam Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, counsel for the state, Ms. Jarrett, and their amicus, Mr. Peterson. David Klukas, on behalf of Brandon Hoffman, if the court would permit, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I could. The proposition of law that brings us here this morning, as advanced by Mr. Hoffman, is that there can be no good faith reliance by law enforcement officials on an arrest warrant issued without a magisterial finding of probable cause. And I don't think that there's any serious argument in this matter that the misdemeanor complaints at issue do not comply in any fashion with the federal and state constitutions, nor with the rules of this court governing the issuance of criminal complaints.
Mr. Klukas, could I ask you if the municipal court has changed its procedure, and if so, when that took effect?
I cannot answer from firsthand knowledge. I've heard, but I don't know. I've never had a situation like this one where I've had to go look, and sadly, I don't do a great deal of misdemeanor work, so I don't know, but I can share with the court that I believe that there are, people are suggesting that it has, in fact, changed. I don't know that that's necessarily a dispositive fact in this particular case. I know that both the state in their merit brief and various amicus had cited to a newspaper article. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the sort of proof that we're looking for that the change has occurred. So I'm sorry.
If we can go back in time, though, at the time that these were not being issued in a proper way, is there any evidence in the record that the police knew that the clerk was issuing these warrants improperly? Was there any evidence in the record?
I believe that Detective Clark testified, and particularly in the August 24th hearing, that he knew that a probable cause determination needed to be made, and that he had testified that nobody had ever made one. Whether I can extrapolate that out to the entire Toledo Police Department, I don't think we can do that on the record. I do believe that the testimony from each officer who testified indicated that nobody had ever asked them any questions at the Toledo Municipal Court, nobody had ever rejected a warrant, and that they knew that when they went to get a search warrant, for instance, officers testified that they knew they had to make a probable cause presentation to the issuing magistrate. And again, I think it's worth repeating that Detective Clark testified that he knew that there had to be a probable cause determination made prior to the issuance of an arrest warrant. And clearly there was not, most importantly in this case, but I think as a pretty salient secondary matter for the decision here, it wasn't happening at all in any cases. I think that's a very fair inference from the testimony that that was adduced at the suppression hearing. The deputy clerk who was in charge of the criminal division said that in the 17 years that she ran it, nobody had ever.
Counsel, doesn't that actually cut against your argument? If everybody is doing it wrong, everybody, doesn't that make it reasonable for the police officer on the beat to have a reasonable belief that it's okay?
No, I don't believe that at all. I mean, the fact that everybody's doing something wrong doesn't make that wrong right. I think we would all agree with that.
What do you make of the Overton decision then from the 6th District? Is it the 6th District that's wrong, or
they were clearly
have
wrong.
They sort of blessed this confusion that you're describing to us?
I would
can
respond.
Can we rely on a decision of the appellate court in that district?
I would respond to that in two ways. To your initial question, were they wrong? The answer is clearly yes, they were wrong.
Okay, but there was no appeal from that decision, right?
There was an appeal from that decision. This court declined to take jurisdiction, and in a 5-4 decision, the United States Supreme Court failed to take jurisdiction.
So the law in the 6th District, as far as any police officer or lawyer would be, we're following that decision.
No, I can't agree with that at all. Because when you take the Overton case and you put it right next to, say, the Giardinello case from the United States Supreme Court, identical issues, identical types of complaints, identical issue raised by the defendant, and the 6th District Court of Appeals in an unreported decision says this is okay, but the United States Supreme Court says, no, this is not okay.
There's been no challenge from the time of that decision in 2000 until this year?
Sadly, that appears to be the case. Until this came to my attention.
So why would you say that a police officer would not be justified in relying on what he would perceive to be the acceptable practice in good faith as blessed by the 6th District Court of Appeals?
Well, I get back to my original answer, which is I do not believe that was binding. I don't think it was worthy of reliance. It's clearly contradicted.
So you think officers should look at which appellate cases they should feel worthy of reliance and which they should feel unworthy of reliance?
I think they should take their constitutional directive from the United States Supreme Court, which is the final
arbiter.
So
we want them looking at all the cases to make determinations.
Yeah, I do. And the other thing is, about Overton, there wasn't any probable cause determination raised in Overton. The Overton decision was limited to the facial sufficiency of the complaint, which is only half of what we're bringing up here. When you look at the history of the Overton decision from the trial court all the way through to the United States Supreme Court, nobody said that there wasn't a probable cause determination. They all assumed there was, even if it was erroneous.
All right.
That's the distinction.
But Mr. Klukas, the police officers can't be held to be so sophisticated in parsing what an appellate opinion means, can they?
No, they can't.
I mean, and the issue is reasonable belief.
Correct.
Reasonable belief. So if they have if there's an opinion that says, here's what you need, the name, address, elements of the crime, et cetera, and then for 17 years they go to the clerk's office, they present that information, they get the warrant, nobody says anything, nobody challenges it for 17 years, how can that not be reasonable when this is how we do it in Lucas County?
I understand. I give you, Your Honor, the same answer. Number one, Overton was all about facial sufficiency. It did not talk about the absence of a probable cause determination. Okay? Number two, I'm not asking police to be ultra sophisticated. What we're arguing here this morning is exactly what the United States Supreme Court in Leon said: reasonable officers are charged with this type of knowledge. And one of the things that Leon charges those officers with is you cannot submit bare bones complaints. They're very clear about that. They mention it two or three times in the majority opinion. A reasonably well-trained officer knows not to do that.
But counsel, isn't this case very narrowly here to decide the good faith of the officer? Isn't that really all we're here to talk about today?
We're here to determine the applicability of the good faith exception. That's correct.
Okay. So you've got a police officer, as Justice Lansinger just mentioned, a procedure that's been followed by everybody for 17 years, and you're saying it is not in good faith for that officer to follow that procedure?
No, I'm clearly not getting the main point of the argument. Even if I were to concede, which I'm not, that Overton is binding, because it's not, okay? It stands in direct conflict with a United States several United States. But let's just say for argument's purposes, okay, they're following Overton. There isn't anything in Overton that allows them to skip the probable cause determination step. Nothing about that in Overton.
But Mr. Klukas, nobody tells them that. Nobody says it. If we make the determination in this opinion, this can't be done, and then we had an officer who, for some reason, went back to the old way, you could say there's no reasonable belief. There's a Supreme Court opinion here that tells you this is what you're supposed to do. This is the problem. We have the judicial, the cases from the judiciary, from the 6th District, and someone at some point presented an affidavit, and it was, or presented rather the complaint, it was issued, and it was issued again and again and again. Nobody challenged it. No attorney challenged it. And so how can there be the duty or the responsibility laid on an officer to say this procedure is wrong?
I have two responses to that. First, officers know, and we know this from the transcript testimony, that you need to have a probable cause determination made by somebody before you get an arrest warrant. Okay, this court doesn't need to tell the officers that. They already know that. They're supposed to know that. That's part of their training. We're not asking them to interpret ultra-sophisticated appellate decisions.
Well, counsel, how do you know that's part of their training?
Because there was testimony from Detective Clark that said that's part of our training.
Okay, and for the last 17 years, they trained this way.
No, I can't say that. For the last 17 years, they got their warrants this way. That's not the way they were trained. They got their warrants in a manner that's inconsistent with the way they testified that they were trained.
Detective Clark testified that for the last 17 years they were trained consistently about how to secure a warrant.
He testified that he was trained, that he knew that he needed to have a probable cause determination made to get an arrest warrant issued, but for 17 years he hadn't had one.
By whom? Made by whom?
By the appropriate, detached, disinterested magistrate as permitted by rule.
You all learned that in the first week of law school.
Right.
The neutral magistrate is a clerk of court. A neutral magistrate?
They can be, but they certainly weren't here.
They can be.
Sure.
So is the police officer now to ask for the credentials of the clerk who asks him to raise his right hand?
I think that they need to recognize, well, they don't have to ask for credentials. They need to recognize that they're going through a probable cause determination, just like when they get a search warrant. It's not a question of credential. It's a question of process.
Well, isn't that what we want them to do anyway? We don't want them going out on the street, taking people off the street and putting them in jail. We want them going to some neutral party saying, this is the information I have. May I have a warrant to arrest this person? And once they do that, then they get it. And now today you're saying, even though they've been doing it that way for 17 years, they can't do that anymore.
No, that's not what we're saying at all. We're saying go to somebody who's going to engage in the appropriate process that you recognize as a consequence of your training.
Well, the official that has been designated in Lucas County and under the auspices of the Sixth District opinion in Overton was that clerk. And that was the procedure that they followed. And that's what we want them to do, isn't it?
We want them to, no, we don't want them to do what they're doing here. No, we don't. We want them to go someplace where they have an actual
probable
cause.
You want the official to be more thorough before issuing the warrant is what you're seeking.
No, I want the police to recognize that the warrant process is appropriate. It's the police who wish to make the arrest.
You find the police are at fault, not the clerk.
I find that the police are more at fault. There is clearly fault to be leveled at the clerk's office. I'm not saying that. But this is the police's job. It's their responsibility to make sure it's done properly.
I understand your argument. Thank you.
Counsel, can I clarify something in the record? And it has to do with this Officer Violante. Are there two of them,
or is there one? It's a husband and wife.
Gotcha. So one of them goes to the clerk's office, gets the warrant. The other Officer Violante serves the warrant. Is part of the 10 officers
that
actually do the arrest.
It's really kind of a coincidence.
Okay, thank you.
If the court has no other questions, I'd like to reserve my last 2 minutes if I could, please.
Thank you. Ms. Jarrett.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for Mr. Peterson to present argument on behalf of the Attorney General's office. This case is about the circumstances under which probative evidence of guilt may be excluded. And the position we're taking is that this court should affirm the Sixth District's decision because the exclusionary rule is not an automatic right that arises upon the violation of some constitutional right.
Is there a violation here in your view, Ms. Jarrett?
We've never seriously contended, Your Honor, that the warrants were facially valid.
Your point is that the officers can rely in good faith on this procedure. Is that it?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And for a couple of reasons, the exclusionary rule is designed to deter future abuses by law enforcement. It doesn't cover misconduct by the judiciary. The other aspect of the exclusionary rule case law that is relevant to this case is, of course, the Overton decision from the Sixth District, which we know from the U.S. Supreme Court precedent in Davis can have an impact on the reasonableness of an officer's belief.
Have there been systemic changes to the process since the time of the filing of this case, to your knowledge?
Yes, and part of it is a matter of record. The police officers changed their procedures by the time the second suppression hearing was held, and there was testimony to that effect. At that time, the court clerk's office was still looking at their process, but that was subsequently changed. That change is not part of the record.
And who is the issuing officer now?
I believe that the deputy clerks, according to news stories, the deputy clerks were trained to make the probable cause determination based on the facts presented to them, the evidence presented to them by the officers.
So this decision is dealing with a system that is no longer in place in Lucas County.
That's correct. So in terms of future deterrence, I would argue that the impact of the decision would be limited. We would have
How extensive should we write in this case, in your view? How extensively should we articulate procedures?
If you're requesting, I'm not sure of the scope of the question.
It's a pretty broad question.
no scope.
I think that the case law, even from the Sixth District, has overruled Overton. They've said that this probable cause determination has to be made. If we're talking about the exclusionary rule jurisprudence, then the rule that I would advocate is that the exclusionary rule has to take into account the precedent within the district of the police department. It also needs to take into account the fact that one of the key parties here was not law enforcement.
But this is a good faith issue, the exception on good faith. So what would you have us write?
The propositions of law that I would advocate is that the exclusionary rule will apply, and then we could articulate the kinds of rules that were set forth in hearing, that it's going to look to I believe that hearing actually began to examine the more subjective intent of the police
officer.
Yes,
that's my point. It's been written, and everybody knows what it is, so.
And I believe, Your Honor, that the Sixth District appropriately applied the U.S. Supreme Court precedent in this particular case. They looked at the hearing decision. They looked at Davis. They analyzed the circumstances that led to the officer obtaining the warrants in this case, followed by the investigation of the murder.
Ms. Jarrett, I'm concerned if we write something, or the Court of Appeals has overturned Overton, and if I understand this correctly, once this procedure, as invalid as it may be, once it occurred, these warrants went into the computer system. They were put into the computer, so they're in there. All of these invalid warrants are in there, and they may be used in the future. May they be used in the future? What do we do about cases that will come up and, you know, somebody's pulled over at the side of the road, the police officer checks the computer, there are four warrants for an arrest, which may be invalid? What happens in a situation like that? I'm concerned about the 17-year backlog for this jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that if I were to advocate application of law moving forward, I would take the position that if the warrants were issued in compliance with the procedures that were in effect before Overton, if those warrants were issued during that time leading up to, I'm sorry, not Overton, but in the decision here by the Sixth District, which overruled Overton, that we would get the benefit of the reasonableness of reliance on the prior case law.
But what you would be saying is a 17-year period, all of those warrants are totally invalid and unenforceable?
No, I'm sorry. I would be saying that those prior warrants, if they were issued before the Sixth District overruled Overton, they would still be valid. They would be valid based on the date of their issuance as opposed to the date of their service.
So if we find this warrant valid based on the good faith reliance of the police officers, all similarly situated warrants will still be valid even if they are unserved?
That's the position I would take. Obviously, that would be an issue that might crop up in a future case, and I would anticipate that we would probably wind up having to litigate.
You're making me nervous in the proposition you're giving to Justice O'Donnell, however. Are you suggesting that this court now has the ability to expand the term neutral magistrate to include the clerk with the rubber stamp at the desk?
Your Honor, I'm not. We've not contested the neutrality.
We're talking about warrants for arrest of people.
Yes, and certainly it is a serious thing. We would want that
serious constitutional implications.
Absolutely. We don't mean to undercut any of the what's really a foundational part of our Constitution. But what we are saying is that when we have reliance on authority that appears to say this procedure is fine, and really the entire community, it's not just police officers, but there are public defenders who routinely handle these kind of misdemeanor warrants, and they were relied upon by the entire legal community.
Ms. Jarrett, my concern, though, is if we make a determination that they were not issued appropriately under Criminal Rule 4A1, you know, talks about the arrest warrants, how they're supposed to be issued, how they're supposed to be served. And my concern is that once we say this was not done appropriately, not done according to the Fourth Amendment, they can't be relied on in the future. How can they be relied on in the future?
I would expect the defense bar to make that argument.
I would
take the position that if those warrants were served, that the good faith of the officer is measured at the time of the issuance.
Well, wait a minute. You say served, but, you know, we've got, apparently there's this question about the unserved warrants that are sitting someplace, and if someone is pulled over for a traffic and they find out that they've got some warrants, okay? Now, if we rule that the warrant here is permissible based on the exclusionary rule and the good faith reliance and the et cetera, what's the status of those warrants? And they would have to be, in accordance with our opinion, if we ruled this way, still valid to be served, to have an impact on the defendant who is the subject of the warrant.
I would.
That's your position.
I would expect that I would be taking that position if someone contested the validity of a warrant served, but one that had been obtained pre Hoffman decision from
but
the
Sixth
District.
This is another case for us. That's a case down the road. That's not a decision that we make here prospectively. I mean, we can say from now on, all the warrants that are served in Lucas County or in this jurisdiction need to be done according to this method. And from what you're saying, there's been some revision and education to that effect.
That's correct.
Okay, but the impact of what our ruling will be today on another defendant is yet to be determined and is not before us today.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor. So that kind of issue would...
But what's before us today is a murder conviction, correct?
That is correct, and it's a particularly brutal murder. It's one where there was a great deal of concern for public safety because from the moment the victim's body was found, it was known that at least one gun was missing from his home. And given the violence of the...
And an argument is being made that an invalid warrant led the police, among other things, to that location.
That's correct. I would dispute that the warrant alone led him to that place.
I'd be disappointed if you didn't dispute that.
Yes, Your Honor. The testimony at the suppression hearings was that the officers first learned of the identity of a man named Brandon who lived across the street from the victim. So they consult property records. They find that Brandon Hoffman was linked to that address. They put that information into Norris. And there was clear testimony at the second suppression hearing that Norris includes not just the warrants, but it also includes things like driver's records. It includes a great deal of identifying information about individuals so that the address did not necessarily come from the warrants themselves.
But counsel, even if you say that the discovery of him as a person was inevitable, how does that also lead then to the discovery of the gun and the cell phone? Can you talk about that?
The cell phone was lying away from the defendant. It was lying in plain view. It was not located under his body. When officers entered the room to make the arrest of Mr. Hoffman, they pulled him to his feet, and beneath his body, there was the victim's gun. At that point, he's under arrest for the misdemeanors. He was removed. A detective arrives. He sees the cell phone. He's already looking for the victim's cell phone. The victim's girlfriend had said, "I haven't heard from him." There was actually blood spatter that outlined the cell phone and the location where she indicated he kept the cell phone. So he had another individual call the victim's cell phone number, and at that point the phone rang and the officer testified, "I knew I had probable cause then. I cleared the house. I shut everything down. I got a search warrant." We searched and found additional evidence linking him to the crime. The gun under his body would be, I think, probably the subject of a very vigorous defense position that would be hard to separate out. If there are no other questions for me, I'll reserve the remaining time for Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson, you have less than 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. I'd like to briefly just make 2 points. First, I'd like the rule that the state would like the court to write in this case would be that police officers act in good faith when they obtain a warrant from a neutral magistrate pursuant to procedures that have been reviewed and upheld by a court of appeals. And second, the reason that we would ask the court to write such a rule is that it is consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court's recognition of the significant cost imposed by the exclusionary rule.
Counsel, for us to say that, do we have to find that a clerk at the counter is a neutral magistrate?
Your Honor, there's no dispute, I think, in this case that a clerk can be a neutral magistrate. And the question of neutrality.
When you say there's no dispute to that, what do you mean?
That certainly a clerk, no one has said that a deputy clerk does not have the power to issue arrest warrants. And the question of neutrality is one, if you look to the U.S. Supreme Court's case in Logi Sales, for example, that was a case where you did not have a disinterested magistrate. Or if you look to this court's decision in State v. Hobbs, I believe, that is what is meant by when you don't have a neutral magistrate. It's someone who is associated with the police. But when you do have a neutral magistrate who issues the arrest warrant, the police are entitled to rely in good faith on that. And you just need to put themselves in the shoes of the police officers here, who obtained a warrant from a magistrate pursuant to procedures that have been followed, that have been upheld by a superior court.
You said you had 2 points. The first one was a good faith exception on approval of a neutral magistrate in decisions in accordance with the district.
And the second point,
Your Honor. What was your second point, Mr. Peterson?
Your Honor, it's that because of the significant cost imposed by the exclusionary rule, the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently required that there be culpable police conduct and that suppression of the evidence be necessary to deter future police misconduct.
Is there any culpable police conduct in this case, in your view?
In this case, in our view, no, there is not, Your Honor. And that's where, again, we would say put yourself in the position of the police officers who obtained and served these
warrants. Mr. Klukas may argue that the police officers should have known that this process, the systemic developments in Lucas County, are at odds with what the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated the law is.
Well, Your Honor, these police officers here were certainly aware that the procedures followed by the Toledo Municipal Court had been followed consistently for several years, that the Overton decision was a decision coming out of the Toledo Police Department, so those officers would have been aware of that. And so whether or not the police officers should have made their own independent determination based on judicial precedent, which we contend they should not have. If you look, even the trial court in this case felt itself bound. And if the trial court, a trained judicial officer, felt bound, how much less could we expect police officers in good faith to make a different determination?
And Mr. Peterson, with regard to the remedy, if these warrants were issued without a probable cause determination, and they're in the computer, they're unserved, and I know it's not, I'm just talking about the future. What you're suggesting is all of these warrants then are potentially available for use later on by the police? Is that, it seems to sweep that under the road, but if we don't really address the issue of violation of the Fourth Amendment by not getting a probable cause determination.
Well, Your Honor, I think that it is significant that the facts would be significantly different after this case, because what you need to do is you need to look to the good faith behavior of the police. And certainly there may be basis to question that, and while we don't concede that point, that is a question that would certainly be relevant looking to all of the facts surrounding that future case. And so in this case, we believe it's sufficient to say that a police officer acts in good faith when they obtain a warrant from a neutral magistrate pursuant to procedures that have been upheld by a court of appeals.
Thank you. Counsel, you have a little less than 2 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you. I want to start by addressing what I perceived as questions from the court regarding the analytical applicability of Leon. We believe that this is a Leon case. What the state's asking for is a Leon remedy, a good faith exception, and I think it is worth repeating that the predicate requirement of Leon is a warrant, a good warrant, issued by a detached and neutral magistrate, and we don't have that here. I don't think the good faith exception applies because of the deficiency in the warrant issuing process.
So you're saying that this was too deficient. In some circumstances, there might be a little deficiency, and you can live with that. But you know, this was too deficient.
This is
both on the police and the magistrate or clerks. So it's not black and white. It's not either or. You're just saying under these circumstances, this is way too efficient.
Way too deficient. That is
okay,
what we're saying.
Okay, but then how do you take a look at the intent of the exclusionary rule, which was meant to punish culpable police officers? Would you agree that there are no culpable police officers here?
No, I would not agree with that.
Okay, why not?
Because I know from the testimony that they know that there needs to be a real probable cause determination, just like when they get a search warrant, okay? And it wasn't happening, and they recognized it, and it was a rubber stamp process.
In some ways you won. If I understood Ms. Jarrett's argument, she said there have been some changes made to the issuing process. Do you agree that that has sort of had a reformation issuance?
I disagree that I've won. I'm not in this to change. I'm in this for Mr. Hoffman, okay? And here I stand.
I didn't say so, Mr. Hoffman won.
So clearly, I haven't won. But I understand what the argument is. I don't have any firsthand knowledge.
I guess my question, though, is have there been systemic changes to the process such that it is now corrected and this isn't likely to be repeated?
From a secondhand perspective, I would have to say yes. I don't know for sure, but that's what I've heard.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshal, will you please adjourn court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.